Norah Jones and Don't Know Why. 20 past one on BBC Oxford. I'm Jo Tunis. Thanks for joining me this afternoon. Looking ahead to the rest of the day for you in the next 20 minutes or so. But let's focus now on the here and now, because it's time to introduce you to my first guest this afternoon. When Peter Rodiak Gould was 21, he travelled to the Micronesian islands of the Marshall Islands, primarily to volunteer teach on one of the atolls. But in doing so, he developed such an interest and relationship with the population there that when he came to Oxford to study anthropology, he ended up heading back to learn more about the people and their cultures. He didn't realise at the time, though, he'd also find himself addressing the concept of how climate change would eventually render these people homeless as the islands seemingly sink into the ocean, and indeed, how the population dealt with these facts. Now back in Oxford, he's pursuing his studies and joins us today to talk a little bit about his experiences and two books that he's written accredited to that time. Welcome to the show. Thank you for coming in. Now, having grown up in California, in quite a, by your own admission, science-focused family, what sent you off on a tangent to the Marshall Islands?
Yeah, I wish I could give some nice rational reason, but the truth is that I've always been very attracted to remote places. I find myself looking at maps and finding small islands or tiny corners of countries and looking them up online and learning about them. And so the fact that most people haven't heard of the Marshall Islands, and I had barely heard of them, was a selling point for me when I found out that I could go there.
You were 21. Had you just finished college? What were you looking for?
I had just done my undergraduate, and I knew I wanted to volunteer abroad somewhere. And this program, which is done by World Teach, which is a volunteer organization, offered the chance to live on a tiny island in the middle of nowhere. It's the only Westerner in that community, and I simply couldn't pass that opportunity up.
What did your family and friends make of this decision? Was this typically you, or was it completely out of the blue?
It was, to some extent, it was typically me. I'd spent some time abroad before. I'd studied abroad in Spain and taught English there. So I wouldn't say it surprised my friends and family. A lot of them, you know, would make fun of the fact that it was going to be this tropical paradise. And I had this friend who was an engineer living in the basement of this engineering building. And he would say, you know, oh, you're so lucky, you're, you know, right next to this shimmering lagoon and so forth.
But you didn't really know what you were letting yourself in for.
Yeah, no, I really didn't. I knew that I might be getting in over my head, and that was almost part of the appeal. There's something a bit masochistic about it. I didn't want to have a satellite phone. I wanted to sort of have the full experience, and it was sometimes more than I could quite handle, but that's sort of what I was looking for. So
take us through arriving in the islands and what the year held for you.
Okay, so when I first arrived in the islands, there was a month of orientation with the other volunteers. So you get a little bit of an idea of the country, but this was in the capital city, so it's a very different world than the outer islands. And you're sort of lulled into a false sense of security because you've got your fellow Westerners to hang out with. And, you know, you're talking to the locals a bit, but you're not really experiencing that very intense feeling of being alone in the culture. And so then once that month is over, I went on this tiny plane to this outer island, and that was when the real experience began.
You'd had to learn some basics of the language, which wasn't comparable to any language you'd experienced before.
Yes, exactly. So there were very few resources to learn the language. Luckily, I'd studied linguistics as an undergraduate, so I was able to sort of look at these very arcane linguistic tomes and, you know, learn a little bit about the language. But I basically started to learn it for all intents and purposes when I landed on that island.
And in fact, during your time, you wrote a book, didn't you? A vocabulary book, which is being used by students now.
I wrote a textbook for learning the Marshallese language, which the volunteer organization uses now. And it was written for my past self. It's what I wish I had had, something that made it a little bit clearer than these sort of very esoteric sort of linguistic descriptions of the language.
How did you live on this island? Were you taken in by a family? You were working in a school, weren't you?
Yeah, so the volunteer organization set up host families for each of the volunteers. So I was the only volunteer on that island, but I was living with a local family. They didn't really speak any English, which was what I wanted. And so I was immersed in the language, and they fed me all my meals and took care of me in every way. So.
And they do say the best way to learn a language is to immerse yourself in that
country.
But did it actually cause problems as well in that fact there was no one that you could refer to if you did have to communicate something quite important, but there was just this barrier?
That's absolutely true. And when I started to teach, you know, the first few weeks or the first few months, I was supposed to teach the children English, but they didn't really speak any English, very, very little. And I didn't really speak their language. So I thought, you know, what language am I supposed to teach them in? How do I even conduct my class? So it was an incredible challenge.
Language wasn't the biggest challenge for you, though, was it? The isolation was something that really hit you.
Yeah. So this is the islands was a third of a square mile large. You can walk from the ocean side to the lagoon side in about 5 minutes. So this is a very tiny island, and there's no other inhabited islands close to it. So that's quite something to adjust to. Another difficult thing to adjust to, although it was also fun at times, was the fact that on this island, as the only Westerner, you are famous. You are Brad Pitt. And all the children on the island especially are basically the paparazzi and will not let you alone for a moment. And so you get this incredible feeling of sort of being famous and important, but at the same time, you lose your privacy and your autonomy. And anonymity is something that I think we take for granted in our daily lives. But it's something that does not exist at all in small communities.
The structure of the society is very different as well, isn't it, to what we're used to in the West, in that the kids are very much left to their own devices. And so with you paying as much attention to the kids as you did and playing with them, you probably developed a bit of a sort of Pied Piper effect, didn't you?
Right. That was another reason that the children were so interested in interacting with me, not just that I was exotic, but also that I was the only adult who would really play with them or talk to them. The world of adults and the world of children are quite separated in the Marshall Islands. And for a lot of the day, the children are sort of left on their own. And at first that struck me as maybe a little bit neglectful, but then I realized that, you know, this is an island where you can't possibly get lost. You know everyone, you're not going to be kidnapped. And so it's not necessarily a bad life at all for these children.
And their parents, I suppose, are busy during this time growing the crops and fishing, which is how they exist.
Yeah, I think the separation between adults and children has a lot to do with sort of survival and what is quite a harsh environment in some ways. The adults need to do these jobs essentially to keep the family alive, and the children, as soon as they're able to take care of themselves and they don't need sort of constant supervision, maybe at the age of 4 or so, they're pretty much left to their own devices for most of the day. So it makes sense in terms of survival.
We'll talk a little bit more about your teaching, because I know that education isn't as valued as it is in Western society as well here. So you had quite the challenge actually trying to raise standards and get your pupils to reach the levels of the curriculum that were intended. And also talk a little bit about how it inspired you actually to pursue an anthropology sort of avenue, if you like, and why you returned to the islands over the last couple of years. Peter Rudiak-Gould with us this afternoon, and we're talking a little about the Marshall Islands this afternoon, life on the Marshall Islands, of which Peter's written two books. Again, we'll talk more about that in a moment, but the latest on the roads we can get now with Emma. BBC Oxford, the afternoon show with me, Jo Tunis. Last year, Peter Rudiak-Gould returned from the Marshall Islands after his third trip there, a relationship that he built initially with the islands when he volunteered as a teacher at the age of 21. You've been telling us a little bit about that first year that you spent on the islands. It probably seems very strange now looking back at it, because you're so familiar with the culture now, with the people, with the islands. But at the time, it was a completely new world to you. And your role as a teacher on one island in particular led to some very interesting discoveries and revelations for you as far as how their culture differed from ours, because education wasn't really seen as that important.
Right. Well, we take it for granted that education is an important thing and that it's important that our children get good grades and so forth. But Marshallese society is very different, and I think that a lot of that goes back to certain patterns in the culture. For instance, children learn local skills like fishing and preserving breadfruit and things like that by observing the older people, not by sort of formal instruction. So they practice on their own, they observe their elders and so forth, and that's how they learn it. There isn't really a tradition of sitting down with a child and teaching or imparting knowledge. And so the Western school system, which now has sort of been plopped down and imposed on the Marshall Islands, in some ways doesn't fit the local culture. And although most people in the Marshall Islands will say, well, this is very important, education is very important, in many communities there's not a lot of support simply because it's quite foreign to local values.
So when you started at the school, what were you told you were meant to achieve with these students? Was there a curriculum to follow? Were there grades and exams that you had to prepare them for?
There was basically no curriculum. There were a few books, but sort of textbooks to use, but they were entirely inappropriate. They were written for American school children, and they had stories about snowmen and things like that, and that's just completely foreign to someone in the Marshall Islands and not going to really engage the children. And now the lack of curriculum in some ways was a blessing because it meant that I had complete freedom to conduct the classes any way I wanted. But since I didn't have very much experience as a teacher, it was also a bit intimidating. And there was certainly a very steep learning curve. And I wouldn't say that even by the end of the year I was a very good teacher, but I suppose I did my best.
But you did get some good results, didn't you, with a couple of pupils in particular?
Yeah, so my big mission through the year in terms of teaching was that my eighth graders were preparing for the high school entrance exam. And so if you pass this exam, you can go to one of the government-run high schools for free. Otherwise, you'd have to pay, and for many of these children, that would be very difficult. So I tried to prepare my eighth graders for this exam. None of the students on this island had passed for 5 years, but at the end of the year, two of my students did pass. I was very pleased to see that.
That must have been an incredible feeling for you, and indeed for the community and those families.
Yeah, it's you can see the improvement when there's a World Teach volunteer, because of the enthusiasm they bring, and also simply because they're teaching English, and people on the islands, even the teachers on the island who would otherwise be teaching English, don't speak it very well. So having a native speaker really does make a huge difference.
Now, when you signed up for this year project, did you have any idea what influence the experience would have on the direction your life then took?
I really didn't. I barely thought about the country in terms of climate change. Of course, I had heard of sea level rise and so forth, but it was very much in the back of my mind. And, now climate change is in the news constantly. But back then in 2003, it was occasionally in the news, but not very much. And it was very much on the back of my mind, just as I think it was on the back of the minds of the people there. So it was really only when I went back the second time to do research there for my master's degree and realized, first of all, that climate change dwarfed every other issue in the country. And also that I could see increased erosion from the last time I'd been there. That was when I really realized that this was a real problem and something that I ought to study.
Because it was an anthropology master's that
you
came to Oxford to pursue at that point. And did you see that immediately as a chance to return to the island because the culture had made such an impact on you? Or where did the climate change interest actually come from initially?
Well, I wanted to go back to the Marshall Islands because as I learned about anthropology, I would always think back to my experiences there, and it really helped me understand so many aspects of the culture that had baffled me the first time. And so I realized that it only made sense to go back to the Marshall Islands for my fieldwork.
And now the DPhil you're pursuing at the moment, this is really focusing on the climate change and the effect it's having on the population there. And you've seen people's attitudes and the way they're facing what is going to change their lives forever in very different ways, haven't you? You've seen it evolve.
Yes. Well, I think we often think of climate change as purely a scientific or perhaps a political and economic issue, and not so much as a cultural or anthropological issue, but it also has to do with culture. It's going to affect the culture, and the way that people react to this problem is also a very culturally determined thing. So I realized that there was a role for an anthropologist to play in this discussion. And I found that in 2007, the second time I was in the Marshall Islands, people had heard of this idea that the ocean was going to rise, and it was sort of being talked about, but it wasn't sort of a major topic of discussion. Whereas the last time I went back, last year, suddenly various local organizations that started to raise awareness about it, and really it was in the newspaper many times, and it had become this sort of obsession. And I also noticed that whereas in 2007 people were talking about it as a sort of apocalyptic vision of rising oceans that just destroy the country and swamp it and the country disappears, in 2009 the organizations that were raising awareness were sort of detracting attention away from that very frightening image that would sort of turn people off from the problem and focusing more on sort of current manageable impacts of climate change.
Because the reality of the research that's been conducted is that in our lifetimes, the Marshall Islands could realistically disappear from sight.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. And there are certainly some very thorny ethical issues to the awareness-raising strategy. I mean, they're not talking very much at all about migration, the future necessity of migration, and the major impacts that are going to happen. And I think their strategy is to avoid turning people off from the problem, because when there's a very frightening problem and people don't feel that they can solve it, they're very prone to simply denying it and saying they don't believe in it. And in the Marshall Islands, this often comes out in certain religious interpretations of the problem. So some people say, well, scientists say that the islands are going to sink, but God promised in the Bible, he promised to Noah that he would not flood the earth again. And so I believe in God's promise. The rainbow is each time there's a rainbow, that's a sign of God's covenant with people, and so I believe in that. And so there's always that danger, even in such a vulnerable country, there's always that danger to simply dismiss the problem and not prepare for it and not believe in it.
Although scientists' views were taken rather skeptically as well initially, because Marshall Islanders haven't had the greatest relationship with the world of science.
Yeah, so Marshall Islands is a very funny country in a way, because it's very far away from everywhere. It's a tiny country, with a tiny population, only 60,000. But all these sort of geopolitical events keep sort of focusing on it. And one of the most dramatic, or certainly the most dramatic so far, was nuclear testing. So from the 40s to the 60s, the United States was testing nuclear weapons in the country, and this displaced many people and irradiated other people. And after these tests, the Marshallese were in the awkward position of having to rely on scientists to say, yes, your islands are irradiated, so that they could get compensation from the United States government. And sometimes the scientists would say, yes, they're irradiated, and then they would change their mind and say no. And so this created a very sort of complex relationship with scientists. And so from their perspective, it's not obvious that what scientists are saying about climate change is necessarily true.
Now, you've written two books on your experiences, The Fallen Palm, Climate Change and Cultural Change in the Marshall Islands, and Surviving Paradise, which is out this month here in the UK.
Right. So Surviving Paradise is essentially a travel memoir, mostly about the first year that I spent in the country and about my challenges adapting to the local culture and my observations and the experience of teaching and all of that. And in the epilogue, it also it talks about climate change and my second visit to the country and how I saw people dealing with this frightening sort of prophecy.
Does it fill you with hope, the way the islanders are facing the problem of climate change now, or do you worry for them?
Both.
Do you feel protective that they have been sort of so far removed from Western society and the understanding and the imparting of this science that they may not be prepared?
Yeah, I feel both fear and hope. I mean, in terms of hope, I think it's quite admirable that people in the Marshall Islands are now talking about reducing their own carbon footprint, which might sound kind of strange to us because they have such a small contribution to the problem. But the fact that they are interested in doing that shows that they are getting serious about the problem, and it's sort of a wake-up call to the rest of the world. You know, if this small, relatively poor country can reduce its own carbon footprint through solar power and so forth, then we can do that too. And so that definitely gives me hope. On the other hand, no amount of adaptation efforts are going to stop the inevitable, I think. I think that it can delay migration, and perhaps if the rest of the world gets its act together and stops emitting so much, maybe it could stop the migration. But there's a sadness there because people's sense of empowerment about the issue in the Marshall Islands is in some sense illusory, because even if they do everything right, they still might be forced from their homes.
You planning on heading back anytime soon? Is a fourth trip on the books?
Well, I don't have one planned solidly at the moment, but for some reason I can't stop going back there. So I'm sure I will at some point.
No, it's part of you now, isn't it?
It is. And the more research you do, the more questions you try to answer, the more questions you come up with. So it'll never be finished.
Well, it's been fantastic hearing a little bit about that Marshall Islands life from you this afternoon, Peter. Thank you very much indeed. Those books, again, if people are interested in finding out a little bit more, The Fallen Palm, Climate Change and Culture Change in the Marshall Islands, and Surviving Paradise. If you've maybe got a son or daughter who's thinking of heading off on a gap year, it could be some interesting reading for them. Peter survived it. Are they up for the challenge? Eric Clapton now, Knocking on Heaven's Door, and we'll take a look at the events guide for you next.